COVID affecting mental health among caregivers?
Resistance to cancer drugs.
Who's intending to get a COVID vaccine among younger people?
And are triglycerides associated with atherosclerosis?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn first to the COVID material for this week? Because, of course, we passed the grim milestone, the official grim milestone relative to deaths. And also, it looks like we're going to miss another milestone we were hoping for, which was 70% vaccine coverage by July 4th. And that does not look like that's going to be the case. So let's turn to Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, the CDC's publication. They took a look at COVID-19 vaccination coverage and intent among adults aged 18 to 39 years through May of this year. And this, of course, is a cohort that is among those who are not voluntarily going out and getting vaccinated. So they looked at, in the time period from March to May 2021, a survey looking at those folks. And what they found was that only 34% reported that they had received a COVID-19 vaccine, and almost 25% reported that they probably or definitely would not get vaccinated. That's a very daunting statistic, of course. And they said, well, all right, let's look at the factors that are associated with that. Among that cohort, those with lower incomes, lower educational attainment, those who did not have health insurance, who were non-Hispanic Black, and who lived outside of metropolitan areas had the lowest coverage and the lowest intent to get vaccinated.
There was a little over 30% that have been vaccinated, but fully 50% said they either were vaccinated or were intending to. But that still left another 50%, half of whom said they had no intention of doing it, and the other half that said they were still unsure. They probed a little bit deeper and said, okay, as you said, they identified risk factors, but then they asked them the question, well, why is that? It seems like safety and effectiveness were the two major reasons. About 50% were waiting to see if the vaccine was safe. About 40% said that they thought other people needed it more than they did. So if we're going to reach a 70% vaccination rate across the United States, this is the group we need to target.
Exactly. And the CDC, these folks do also say that ensuring that vaccines are easily accessible, convenient, and available in places where these young adults live and work could also improve this coverage and acceptance. I think that's true. There's lots of initiatives underway to give people paid time off and other things so that they can obtain a vaccine.
But unless they're convinced that it's safe, they're not going to get it. When they asked them, what would change your mind? About 39% said, if I thought it was safe, it would change my mind. And about 30% said that they would do it to prevent spreading COVID to their family and friends, which is pretty important as well. So these are the messages that we need to get out to these individuals. It's safe. It is effective. And although you may get COVID and not have severe symptoms, your family or friends could develop severe symptoms and die. And so do it for them.
Well, since we're in MMWR, why don't we stick with this? And let's talk about mental health among parents of children younger than 18 years old and unpaid caregivers of adults during the pandemic and their mental health. Of course, big concern. Early on in the pandemic, almost two-thirds of unpaid caregivers of adults reported adverse mental or behavioral health symptoms, compared with approximately one-third of the folks who were not giving care. In addition to that, almost a third of parents of children younger than 18 years of age reported that their mental health had worsened during the pandemic. So this is a snapshot of, all right, how many people are feeling the stress and it's being manifested as a mental health problem because they're in these caregiving situations. They're either caring for children younger than 18 years of age in the home, they're caring for aged relatives, or both. They surveyed these people, and I think the thing that is most startling to me out of this is this issue of suicidal ideation and just how really prominent it was among these people who have been in these caregiving roles.
The group that we're talking about is a large group of the U.S. population. 40% of the U.S. population is in the role of either parenting a child under the age of 18 or providing care to an adult. And I was surprised to learn that 85% of those that have both those responsibilities had worsening of their mental health behavior, and 50% had suicide ideation. That's 8 times higher than individuals that had no parenting or adult caregiving responsibility. And this suicide ideation was pretty serious. It was not only have I thought about it, but I've thought about ways that I might engage in it. This is very alarming.
It is very alarming. And unfortunately, this potential solution is multifactorial, and it's not going to be easy to implement.
It's not, but we need to recognize that it's not just the individuals that have COVID that are affected. Everybody may be affected in one way or another. Recognizing it's a major need and meeting that need is critical.
They recommend tailored mental health services. And to me, that suggests even more of a barrier, because if we need to assess this on an individual level and then tailor it to the individual, we have a lot of individuals to try to intervene.
Right.
So one of the durable lessons of COVID that we really need to get our arms around providing mental health care services, because this need for caregivers is projected to increase as the U.S. population continues to age.
Yeah.
Which of your two would you like to turn to first?
Let's talk about resistance to cancer drugs. We have spent a fair number of podcasts over the last 2 decades talking about individualized therapy. There was a time where we looked at cancer as being a part of an organ. You got a specific treatment if you had liver cancer or lung cancer or colon cancer. Now we realize that each of these cancers has specific pathways that cross different organs. And so what we're trying to do is hone in on those particular pathways to provide individualized cancer therapy. One of those is directed to what's called KRAS. It's one of the most commonly mutated oncogenes in cancer. This KRAS functions as a switch. It's in the off or on form. And when it's in the on form, what it does is it promotes tumorigenesis, or tissue developing into tumors. And we have developed specific therapies designed against this KRAS, and they have been successful. Unfortunately, individuals can develop resistance. So what these authors attempted to do was to define how that occurs. So they looked at 38 individuals, 27 had lung cancer, 10 had colorectal cancer, and 1 had appendiceal cancer. And they looked at the different mechanisms, hoping that you find a single mechanism and we could attack that. Well, unfortunately, what they found is it's not a single mechanism. In some, it's an alteration in the KRAS gene. In some, it's not KRAS, but it's the other pathways underneath it that are influenced. And in some individuals, the tumor actually changed. These investigators give us some insight on how difficult it is to address these particular issues.
Right. So let us just note that this is in the New England Journal of Medicine. One of the issues I think that this brings up is that we probably are going to need sequential genomic analysis of people's tumors as they live. And if their cancer recurs, because a recurring cancer is not the cancer you started with. And this is really going to pinpoint the need for that genetic analysis virtually continuously.
Absolutely. What happens when you start treating a cancer, there are very strong selective pressures. There's a convergence of these different resistance mechanisms. For example, some of these individuals, about 40%, didn't have a single resistance mechanism. They had several different ones. And so you're right, characterizing the tumor as we treat it, providing sequential therapy or combination therapies based upon that as well. Again, treating cancer isn't as simple as it seems. A single cancer, a single drug, a single cure is going to take continued, as you said, genetic analysis. You think you get it right at the headwater and all these little tributaries will take, that's not the case. These little tributaries end up circling back around and still driving tumor growth as well. So more to learn.
Absolutely. Now let's turn to the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, this ongoing issue we were talking before we recorded about how we seem to talk about so many different topics again and again as more information is uncovered. And we've quipped, of course, should we put statins in the water? Now this look at, even if you do that, maybe you're not going to be able to ameliorate a lot of the cardiovascular disease.
Everybody's familiar with the fact that cholesterol is associated with atherosclerosis, or hardening the arteries. It affects the brain and affects the arteries in the heart and arteries throughout the body and the limbs as well. And that's associated with cholesterol, and particularly low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. There's been a lot of controversy about whether triglycerides in and of themselves are independently associated with atherosclerosis. And because they are associated with these other cholesterols, trying to tease that out hasn't been particularly easy. But what these authors did was they took a unique approach. They took over 30 3,700 middle-aged individuals that had low to moderate risk of having atherosclerosis. That is, they had a normal or low LDL cholesterol. So they weren't at risk for atherosclerosis. They didn't have any atherosclerosis. But then they examined their subsequent risk of developing it by looking at three different measures. One is they did a sono of eight different arterial systems in the body. Number two, they looked at coronary artery calcification, so they could look at progression in the heart. And the third thing was they measured was inflammation. And what they discovered is even in individuals that had low or normal cholesterol levels, particularly LDL cholesterol, the triglyceride level was associated with the development of subclinical, that is, they didn't have symptoms, atherosclerosis in the arterial system, and a twofold increased risk of inflammation. Now, interestingly enough, there wasn't more calcium in the heart, but oftentimes that's a later phase. That is, you develop inflammation first, develop some deposition of atherosclerosis, and then develop calcification late. So that's not terribly surprising. I think this is another piece of the puzzle that suggests that triglyceride levels are in fact associated with atherosclerosis, even in individuals who have normal cholesterol. Now, the next question is, if you treat it, can you prevent it? And that we don't know the answer to. You say, well, of course, it just makes sense. Well, sometimes things make sense, but they just don't particularly work out. For example, we know that if high HDL levels are associated with decreased atherosclerosis, HDL cholesterol. But when we raise those levels, it didn't actually help at all. So even though we've made an association between triglycerides and atherosclerosis, we can't take the next step yet and say that treating the triglycerides alone is going to lower your cardiovascular risk or risk of stroke.
Yeah, and this is so disappointing, isn't it? It sounds an awful lot like the KRAS pathway, where we really thought we had identified something that was the smoking gun, and it turns out that it's not the whole story.
Well, you know, there are oftentimes pieces of the story. And the reason why this is important is we have people with low or normal LDL cholesterol that still develop atherosclerosis. So you say, well, what is that about? And is there something we can do to prevent that? So now we know what that something else may be is triglycerides. The next step is to say, let's take these same individuals, low to moderate risk, and lower their triglycerides over a long period of time and see if we can prevent future atherosclerotic events like stroke or heart attack. So I'm sure that will be coming down the road.
Yes. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.